You and I back together again midweek Wednesday, December 14th of 2022, right here on Connecticut Today, where we looked back on the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School attack in Newtown. Connecticut Associated Press reporter Pat Eaton offered his recollections of covering that tragedy. GOP State Rep. Greg Howard talking about a push from Governor Ned Lamont to possibly reverse a grandfather clause affecting thousands of semi-automatic firearms owners in the state. And a return visit from one of our healthcare authors, Dr. Chad Savage, explaining the growing use of what's called direct primary care. I remember 10 years ago today, on December the 14th, 2012, I was on a train heading south on the Metro North New Haven line, and I got a text, and, you know, my phone vibrated, and I looked down. I was, as I remember, I was almost kind of, you know, as I like to say, dozing off on the train, as I've joked before. You know, train sleep with me is beautiful. I can do it, you know, almost in an instant. And I, you know, stop short of saying, I'll look at the text later, because you never know. It could be something with a family member or whatever. And at the time, my mom was still alive and she wasn't doing well. So I looked at it and I didn't quite recognize the phone number, but I did recognize the name. And this is a person who I had worked with at another job in New York City, who had just gotten a television job here in Connecticut. And this person was just kind of looking at the lay of the land, and or learning the lay of the land. And I remember this person asking me something to the effect of, in the text that I had gotten, who is the, what is the name of the state police spokesperson again? And I sent her some information. I said, why? And I texted her back, why, what's going on? And she texted me, you know, can't talk right now, horrible shooting at a school. And I just went, wow. And I remember, as the train was chugging down the tracks into New York, you know, texting, I wasn't in the mood to get on the phone and start yapping in the middle of the train car, but I was texting a lot of people I knew, and within about 10 or 15 minutes, it was the worst news that anybody or anybody in the state that day, or even anybody with a small child, you know, who sends a child to a school any day would want to hear. And now here we are 10 years since Sandy Hook in Newtown, the mass shooting there. And that's how I found out. I'm sure a lot of you, for a lot of you here in the state, I'm sure it's one of those things that you may remember generally, if not specifically, where you were when you heard about that, much the way, if you're old enough, you tend to remember where you were when you heard about JFK, or you tend to remember where you were when you heard or saw the first reports on, you know, regarding 9/11 or the Challenger disaster in 86. But again, this hits, you know, very, very close or closely to home. So it's been 10 years. And again, when you look back at things that are marked with 5 and 10 year markers, you sit and you think back, you say, wow, could it, how has it possibly been, you know, that long? But it has been. And I wonder, whenever we have these milestones, I don't mean milestones in a good way. I mean, like, you know, mile markers. It's been a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5, 10, 15, 20, whatever. I always look at that and go, okay, so what has changed to any great extent since then? And there's all the posturing and the politicking. Let me just say from the outset, this is beyond horror. I mean, and I know I shouldn't have to say that, but there will likely be some people who are going to hear some of what I'm saying today, which I've said before, say, well, how can you be so crass? Well, I'm not trying to be crass, but we have to be careful when we look back at these things and we mark these 5, 10, 15, 20-year markers, and we say a lot of the right things, but to me, personally, me, your buddy, your pal here, just talking about this, and, you know, I always try to be as honest with you as I can. I say, well, the years aren't important. What has been achieved during that time? What have we actually done? Has our thinking on this changed in any way? Are we frankly and upfront looking at what caused Sandy Hook or what continues to cause tragedies like this? You know, and sadly, at least this is my impression, and believe me, I know that these parents, I don't know how they go on in their daily lives, the parents and relatives of these kids that were killed at Sandy Hook. I mean, in the years after this, you know, back then my son was still relatively young. He wasn't, you know, all that young. He was, you know, had graduated from high school, was heading to college. But, you know, you kind of replay this in your mind, right, back and forth. Oh, my God, the fear that you would get. Getting a phone call from a police official or pulling up to school to pick up your kid. And somebody says, well, who's your son or daughter? And you tell them, you say, can you follow me, please? I mean, oh, my God, what those parents. And you're reading about those memories today in the Hartford Courant and the Hearst papers and all that. But, you know, you stop and think to yourself, my God, how would I have been able to handle it? Would I have been able to handle it? Would I have just, you know, not wanted to be alive anymore? So, but for the grace of God, go myself and millions of other parents, but not for the parents who lost loved ones at Sandy Hook. But again, amidst all the remembrances, all the good-intentioned things that have come out of this in 10 years, and Lord knows there have been, led largely by the parents and relatives and loved ones of those kids that had their lives taken from them. But in that 10 years and in the years to come, how much are we really going to confront about, you know, what caused Sandy Hook, what didn't cause Sandy Hook, and the notion that I think, and I hate to say this on a day like today, but if I'm going to be consistent, I will tell you, and I think you can understand where I'm coming from. We in this country tend to be extremely, I'm trying to look for a delicate word here. We tend to be extremely and very situationally conscious of how we refer to situations. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, and I've said this before, gun violence is with us every single day. It is, and it's a fact of life, unfortunately. You know, the vast, 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 vast majority of gun owners are good, responsible people who want to keep a gun for protection or for sport or they collect. That's none of my business and should be none of yours. But we have a horrible double standard here, sometimes in this country. And it's not so much from loved ones. It really isn't. Because a victim is a victim. A survivor is a survivor. Whether you lose a loved one to gun violence in a rich, predominantly white suburb, or whether you lose someone to gun violence in an inner city situation, whether you're in Bridgeport or Hartford or Waterbury or New Haven, and you lose that person to gun violence, maybe not from a long gun, a semi-automatic, but from a pistol. And those victims tend to be young, African-American, Hispanic, minority, whatever. A death is a death, a tragic, untimely death of violence is a death. Yet we somehow, and not just with Sandy Hook, not just with Newtown, as horrible as that was, and believe me, I can only sense a little somewhat of what these families are going to, because again, I have lost a family member to gun violence, and you're mad and you're angry and you're shocked and you say, dear God, please let this be a dream. And most of the times it isn't. It wasn't for my family. It's not for these families. But the thing that And I'm not pointing this at the survivors, the families. I mean, we've interviewed them here on the show and on the station here and the other programs, and these people are amazing, the way they can soldier on and channel a tragedy in their lives to do good. But I get a little, what's the word I should plug in here and still be somewhat nice? I get a little jaded at some of our lawmakers who, I guess they're saying what they think they have to say, and that's all well and good. But whether it's Sandy Hook or whether it's the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas School in Florida, whether it's, you know, any of the other mass shootings here, everyone, you know, jumps on these, and they are horrific events. I'm not diminishing that at all. But how many people do you think are going to be killed tonight in American cities? And how many people do you think are going to be killed in the state here? And one of our guests coming up later on will tell us that, you know, a lot of people who commit gun crimes in this state that are not mass shootings per se never get the charges followed fully against them. A lot of these charges are nullied, especially when it comes to urban violence in this state. So again, and what are your thoughts on this? I'd like to just find out where you are 10 years post Sandy Hook. What are your thoughts on this? Are we as jaded on this, or at least from our political leaders, as you think we are? Do we not talk about maybe what was really behind this, which was neglect at properly storing guns and keeping them away from someone who had a very, very difficult mental state to handle? Does it upset you that a lot of our political and local leaders seem to come out crawling out of the woodwork when it's, you know, largely suburban white kids that get killed, which is horrible, don't get me wrong. But where is the concern for the inner city crime? Where is the concern that plagues people in neighborhoods every day in Bridgeport, in Hartford, in New Haven, in Waterbury, in New London? Where is that? Or is that too difficult to actually confront? When we talk about tragedies that happen on a national scale or on a local scale, as we are talking about today, 10 years removed, physically at least, not mentally or emotionally, from what happened at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, we always talk about the victims with good reason, the victims' families, loved ones, survivors with good reason, the law enforcement people, the first responders, again, all with good reason. But increasingly, stories are told about reporters and journalists who cover these things. It goes all the way back to people who covered World War One and World War Two and the JFK assassination. And a professional friend of mine wrote a book about how reporters, many high-profile folks, covered 9/11, for example. Gentleman right now was one of the reporters who had to keep everything in perspective and cover what happened 10 years ago today. I first worked with him at a radio station a long time ago. He has since gone on to a great career at the Associated Press, writing and covering stories all across Connecticut and news and features and sports, and many of his stories have been picked up nationally. Pat Eaton Robb is with us this afternoon right here on WICC. And Pat, well, if I can get the, there it is. I had to click multiple times. Pat, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Paul, I'm doing okay. It's nice to talk to you again. Long time.
Yeah, it's been too many years. It's sad we have to talk about this, but I did want to bring you on because you did post a couple of remembrances and things I saw on Facebook, and I got to wondering. I said, you know, not enough people, Pat, realize that as reporters, journalists, we go into some pretty dicey situations. I've been there once or twice in my life, but nothing like you dealt with 10 years ago today. Take us back, Pat, and what do you remember about that day?
Sure. First of all, I want to say what we reporters went through that day. While difficult, it was nothing compared to what the people of that town and what the families and everybody else went through. I just want to make that ultimately clear.
Sure.
My first remembrance of that day, I was supposed to host the office Christmas party on Saturday. So I was actually off, supposed to be off that Friday. I was at a Walmart picking up supplies when I first got word that we had a report of a school shooting, possibly a teacher being shot in the foot. That was fairly early in the morning. And so I called in and I said, is this something that you need me for? And they were like, probably not, but we'll let you know. And then I got a call back saying, hey, we're hearing that that there were some children involved. Can you head down there? And so that was my initial, knowledge of the whole incident. So
where were you physically in the state, Pat? You were where?
I was in Willimantic, Connecticut.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the northeast corner. So, yeah, so I had about a 90-minute drive to get down to Newtown. I remember stopping. I stopped in on 691, pulled off to the side of the road to take the antlers and the red nose off my car.
Jeez.
Knowing what I was going to be covering, and then I arrived at the firehouse. There were probably already 10 reporters there. They kept us across the street. And by that time, I ran into my colleague John Christofferson, who had been there for a while. And he just whispered in my ear that he was trying to confirm what he had heard from a source. And he gave me the number. And my face went white and pretty much stayed in shock for the rest of the day as we, talked to people and tried to confirm everything that happened. And
you're in shock. You said that. And that's the thing that people have to remember. You know, you're in shock here. You're a human being. Yeah, you're a reporter, but you're hearing this. But then you have to say, hey, wait a minute, though. This is horrible. It's getting worse, but I've got to do my job.
Yeah. Well, I had covered, I had covered 9/11. Talked to the families of the Connecticut victims there, and I was down covering that, and I thought to myself, well, this will be the worst thing I ever have to cover. And then 2007, what happened in Cheshire with the Pettit family happened, and I thought, well, it's never going to get worse than this. And unfortunately, I was very, very wrong about that. So when you get down there, and it's, the environment and the news, it's very competitive, but it's also, and being the AP, our job is to get it fast, but to get it right. And so that was our mission at the beginning. Was there was so much flying around, so many stories. This network was reporting that, there was still somebody in the woods that they were looking for. And this network was reporting that there were two gunmen, and this network was reporting this person did it, and they had found his ID on the scene, and it turned out to be the brother. And so you have to be, you want to be fast, you want to be first with whatever you can be, but you also need to be right. And that was our, and it's always, you're never 100% right, because the people you're talking to are never 100% right at the early stages of these things. And what it, what they say doesn't always turn out to be true. So we were very slow. I'm not going to say slow. We were pretty fast in reporting what had happened. But you want to get the numbers right. You want to, confirm that it's children. You want to get multiple sources to tell you what had happened. And everything we were hearing. And just, you develop relationships with police spokespeople and others on the force. And just the looks on their face and saying, I can't, when they were telling you they can't say anything, and you would just see them turn white, and you just knew immediately that this was awful.
Yeah, and
like nothing else.
Sure, and Pat Eaton-Robb is with us, longtime Associated Press correspondent here in Connecticut. Pat and I worked at a radio station years ago, and Pat, you mentioned this morning on Facebook that, you covered this, but this is the kind of thing that kind of never goes away, talk about coming into contact with some of the victims' families and survivors as you did that day and then later days and over the years here.
Yeah, well, that was the hardest part, was having to go knock on doors. What do you say? What do you say when you knock on a door and someone answers and they or their family has just lost a 6-year-old? How do you ask them? So that was tough. And so, that day what you did was you made contact with, someone who would be a spokesperson for the family or the funeral home or, somebody else who you didn't, you know, have to talk directly to a parent. But eventually, you know, in the few days and covering the funerals and then starting to get to know these people, my assignments became, you know, how are the families, what are they doing to cope with this? And so I started doing the, not good news stories, but the stories about the foundations they set up, the stories about what they were receiving from other people, the stories about how they were remembering their children through, well, just to talk about a person who's become an acquaintance of mine. I won't say a close friend, but we know each other now, and Rebecca Kowalski, who her son Chase was a six-year-old athlete. He saw this thing on TV where people were running and biking and swimming, and he wanted to try that. So this is the six-year-old, just a few months before, had run this mini youth triathlon, you know, where he got on his little McQueen bicycle and rode, and they ran. And so what they did was teamed with the YMCA down in Waterbury, and they started a program in which they teach kids how to swim and teach them to ride bikes, and they do a 6-week program, and then at the end of it all the kids do a triathlon and they receive bicycles, and it's grown to 3 states and some I don't know the number of YMCAs who are involved, but a lot, and it's an amazing program, and they're amazing people. And just to get to know them and other families like the Gays and who are doing the Safe Schools Initiative and the Bardens and the Hockleys who did Sandy Hook Promise, and just how all these families and there's a website that has. That they point people to that has all the families listed there in every one of their foundations. And it truly is amazing how these people have, you know, lived with this tragedy and, and done something with it, positive. And that they just amaze me. Never cease. So I've been covering, we told them at the beginning, you know, when all the news media from across the world were descending on them, you know, we told them who we were, and that we were in Connecticut, and that we would still be here 5 years, 10 years down the road, and we are, and we continue to do stories about them. And I guess that's how I kind of get through it too, is that I try to do something positive, you know, forwarding their messages on, explaining to people what they're doing to make something out of this.
Pat, thank you. We appreciate the time here. Pat Eaton, Rob, used to work with Pat in radio years ago, and he's gone on to a distinguished career with the Associated Press here in Connecticut. And as you just heard, Pat was early on the scene and stayed there for a while. One of the press members, obviously, covering the tragedy 10 years ago today at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Pat, good to talk to you. Stay well, and we will surely chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Great, Paul. Keep up the work.
I'll try, Pat. You too. Thanks, folks. Pat Eaton, Rob there. He was just minding his own business. What did he say? Buying stuff for the company Christmas party. Gets a call. Hey, there may be something going on. Well, on the way there, could be a kid involved, could be a teacher involved, and look what it ended up being. So Governor Ned Lamont raised quite a few eyebrows the other day, including many of those eyebrows on his own side of the aisle, who said, hey, in light of the upcoming 10-year mark since Sandy Hook, and also because of the tragic shooting of two Bristol police officers, maybe the state should go back and, in a sense, eliminate the grandfather predictions, the grandfather clause, and the grandfather protections, I should say, that allowed about 80,000 certain types of armaments to be still privately owned in the wake of a bill that was passed in the early 90s and then something that was passed right after Sandy Hook. Joining us right now is a gentleman who has thoughts on that. He is the ranking member, the ranking Republican member on the General Assembly's Public Safety Committee. He's a law enforcement officer. He's been on the show before. State Rep. Greg Howard joins us. Greg, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, sir. Good afternoon, and how are you?
Good, good, good. Great to have you back, Greg. First of all, before we get your thoughts on this, you had some very interesting statistics about gun crime prosecutions in the state. In that story in the Day, Greg, that you were quoted in, it seems like a lot of people in the governor's own party want, at least in, out front on this, Greg, looks like they want nothing to do with this.
No, well, let's, you know, several of my Democratic and Republican colleagues don't want to go back on a deal that was made with, you know, rifle owners back in 2014. And, you know, we're all very well aware that today's a 10-year anniversary. It's something we've all spoken about. I'll tell you, Paul, my sons right now are 13. My youngest one will be 12 next 3 days. So that sort of, you know, definitely hit home to me. I remember when I got that news, I was standing outside my oldest son's preschool classroom, just tears rolling down my face, and I could cry now talking about it. Just it hits you so hard as a parent, and you know, certainly your heart breaks for any parent who goes through those tragedies. Unfortunately, throughout my life, in my 21-year career in law enforcement, I've had to deliver, you know, devastating news to parents on more times than I care to remember. So, you know, certainly, you know, your heart breaks to remember, and as I said to several students that I had an opportunity to speak with today, adult high school students, you know, I wish we lived in a world where there was no evil. I wish that people wouldn't harm each other and everybody was kind and cared for one another. But unfortunately, that's not the world that we live in. We live in a different world, and we have to, you know, make adjustments to live in that world.
Greg, what was the deal then that allowed a certain class of these weapons to be retained by law-abiding gun owners who already had them, I guess, early in the 90s and then post Sandy Hook? What kind of deal did the state give and all these people took advantage of?
Yeah, so what happened was, you know, anybody who owned, for example, you know, a lot of people like to talk about AR-15s, and interesting enough, a lot of people talk about them, and they really don't know what they're talking about, but the AR-15 platform, you cannot purchase after, I think it was 2014, I have to look at the statute, something like that, but if you owned it prior to that and properly registered it with the state, you're able to keep it, and you can currently own it today, and that's an important thing to talk about, Paul, and I'd like to talk about those statistics
sure.
that you saw that were quoted in the Day, and I have some others if you don't mind me sharing.
Sure,
it
go right ahead. Go right ahead.
So, you know, anybody who owns an AR-15 rifle in the state of Connecticut today, well, owned it at least 8 years legally and has not had a problem, because if they did, they would have had it taken away from them. So, for example, I've owned an AR-15 rifle personally since 2008, which I own it, you know, for purposes of my employment. I own an AR-15 rifle. I've owned it that entire time. And if I had displayed some sort of alarming behavior, irresponsible behavior, it would have been taken from me. It would have been seized and it would have been destroyed, or turned over to state police for appropriate use. But the point is, you know, the governor is talking about taking rifles, personal property, away from people who have shown at least 8 years of responsible gun ownership with that firearm. Meanwhile, I'd like to share some of these. Yeah, I think your last caller talked about, you know, parental responsibility
yeah.
with firearms that they own. Well, let's talk about that for a minute. 2021, 100% of the charges for criminally negligent storage of a firearm in the state of Connecticut were nollied or dismissed. That means they were not prosecuted. 2020, 100% of the criminally negligent storage of firearm charges were nollied or dismissed. Illegal possession of a weapon in a vehicle in 2021, 82% nollied or dismissed. Possessing a firearm or deadly weapon on school grounds in the state of Connecticut for the last 4 years, every single charge of possessing a firearm or deadly weapon on school grounds has been nollied or dismissed. Illegal possession of a weapon in a vehicle in 2021 alone, 82% nollied or dismissed.
Mm.
We have a robust process in the state of Connecticut, one that I boast to other legislators from other states because I'm proud of what we do here. We have a robust process to which we ensure that nobody in this state can legally purchase a bullet, for that matter, unless they've been subjected to a background check. Not even any ammunition.
Mm.
So when people go out and steal firearms, in other words, acquire them illegally by stealing them, 2021, 89% of the charges of stealing a firearm, nollied or dismissed. Criminal use of a firearm, 2021, 96%, nollied or dismissed. Criminal possession of a firearm, somebody who possessed a firearm who has a statutory disqualifier, They have a protective order against them. They're a convicted felon. They have mental illness. 66% nollied or dismissed. Illegally transferring a gun to somebody who shouldn't have it. 93% 2021 nollied or dismissed.
Wow.
You tell me. I don't, you know, the governor wants to go and take firearms from people who have proven over 8 years of responsible gun ownership, and we're nollying or dismissing almost all of the criminal charges that we bring against people with firearms. That doesn't make a bit of sense to me, Paul.
And a couple of more minutes right here with our guest. We've had him on the show before. Joining us again, Republican State Rep Greg Howard, Stonington, North Stonington, the ranking member on public safety coming up in the new General Assembly session, also a veteran public safety officer, a police officer. Greg, you gave us some startling numbers before of how many of these gun crimes that happen in the state above and apart from these mass killings are either nollied or not prosecuted. Greg, do we know why? Is it the court system? Is it just all these deals are done, no witnesses? I mean, somebody would hear those numbers and their head might be shaking now. What's up with it?
Yeah, so there's no doubt that part of those are part of plea bargains, the legislature on some of these crimes, not all of them, has mandatory minimum sentences and on gun crimes. So what is happening with, in the judicial system is they're nollying these crimes to avoid those mandatory minimum sentences, but then the conviction doesn't go on the person's record. Right, so this is part of the problem. This is where the governor is completely wrong in his assertion, because what he's asserting he wants to do is put laws in to further restrict the rights of law-abiding citizens in the state when we're not prosecuting the people who violate the law. So why would we, as I said, I spoke with some people earlier today about this, and I gave the analogy. Today's a cold day in Connecticut. It's chilly. You've been outside. If I'm standing outside with my hands and I say my hands are cold and I have gloves in my pocket and you say, well, put your gloves on. And I say, well, I don't want to wear my gloves. What good is giving me more gloves? I'm not going to put them on. I'm not going to use them to my advantage to fix the problem. So why have more? That doesn't even make sense, right? Worse yet, if I'm taking it from you, taking your gloves to not wear them, it doesn't make sense. And that's exactly what the governor is trying to do. You know, we've been saying over and over, and it goes to more than plea bargaining. You know, the majority party does not want to prosecute crimes in the state of Connecticut. You and I have talked about this relevant to catalytic converter thefts. We've talked about it to car thefts. We've talked about it across the board. We don't want to prosecute crimes in this state, but yet we want to make more laws so people who abide by the laws can do less and less things, and the people who are law violators can do as much as they want. We're not going to do anything about it.
And Greg, I said this the other day when the governor brought this up. I said, well, geez, I can understand Greg and maybe not agree with him, but I can understand him floating this if we had a rash of people and the governor said, hey, look, we've got all these crimes here, and we have 90% of these are connected to people who we allowed to keep those long guns or those special guns. I mean, it's not even close. And again, this, Greg, feeds into the fear of some gun owners anyway who don't believe some people on the spectrum when they say, don't worry, we're not coming for your guns. That's kind of what this sounds like.
Yeah, well, it definitely does sound like that, and it promotes, fear among gun owners. But I think it's bigger than that, Paul. I think the bottom line is, if I'm going about my life obeying the law, doing what I'm supposed to do, not bothering anybody else, then why are you taking my things? If I want to go out and buy a Corvette tomorrow and drive it 130 miles an hour down 95, I'm putting everybody else at risk. Do something about it. But don't take my neighbor's Corvette away because he likes to have a fast car when he uses it responsibly and he's obeying the speed limit and doing all the things that he's supposed to do. It doesn't even make sense. You could get deep into the weeds, and some people say, the gun is just a tool. It's the person. And there's truth to that. I've carried a gun every single day for 21 years, and I have, knock on wood, not shot anybody. The guns don't shoot themselves. That's a decision that people make. And do we have a mental health problem? Yes. Do we need to work on it? Yes. We work on it every single day in Hartford. Multiple committees address it. We put massive amounts of funding into it. We work, now it's juvenile mental health has been a problem since the pandemic, and we're putting massive amounts of funding and resources into that. And we're doing that. We're putting more and more effort into school security. But to simply say, well, the solution is going to be we're going to make more laws to take, you know, legal firearms away from law-abiding citizens and not prosecute people who disobey the laws, that's insanity. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a kind of thing, Greg, where people just shake their heads. Greg, thank you. State Rep. Greg Howard, Republican, 43rd District, Stonington and North Stonington. He is the ranking member on public safety. So anything to do with guns, he gets to review and he'll have input. And Greg is also a 21-year veteran police officer. Greg, good to chat with you again. Have a happy holiday season. We'll talk during the session. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it. There you go. Yeah, healthcare sign-up time is happening just now. I think it just wound up, I believe, or is winding up for folks who want to change or alter their Medicare coverage. I have a friend of mine who was talking to him the other day who said, my God, I'm trying to find coverage on the Affordable Care Act website. People pulling out their hair, if they have any left, regarding healthcare. We never seem to get any better, any cheaper alternatives. You know, patients, families never seem to be empowered, but maybe things are changing. We welcome back a gentleman who has been on the show before. Dr. Chad Savage is the founder of Your Choice Direct Care in Brighton, Michigan. He has a very interesting op-ed in RealClearHealth.com that ran a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago. Healthcare, simple as streaming. And Dr. Savage says, hey, if we can get all these streaming services that none of us ever watch but we pay for, maybe we should have choice like that for healthcare. Dr. Savage, hi, it's Paul again on WICC. How are you?
Hey, Paul, it's great to be back.
Well, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it. Now, you drew this interesting parallel, and people are going to say, now, wait a minute. What's he talking about here? Healthcare choice and all these streaming services coming into my house. What's your point there?
Yeah, well, you know, when we think about healthcare, we think about astronomical costs, but we have to really put that into perspective. And I think that when we're in a model called direct primary care, which is it's not a franchise, it's a concept of medical practice that a lot of doctors around the country are starting to adopt because they're trying to get away from the controlled practice of medicine, the impersonal practice of medicine that you get with the third-party payer system, the insurance company, and the government. And the best way to do that is to get back to working for their patients. But we wanted to go away from the fee-for-service model, which means every time you come in, you're paying $200, $300 to see your doctor, because we know that that scares people away from coming in. You know, they feel uncomfortable, they're feeling sick, and they say, well, you know, but I'm sure it'll just pass. You know, I'll just wait. And then by the time they finally do see the doctor, whatever it was that is ailing them is advanced to the point that now they're much sicker. It's much more costly. They can end up in the hospital or even worse. So thinking about in the lines of a membership would actually resolve a lot of that. We're for, and not to sound too much like a sales pitch, I'm not getting anybody from Connecticut coming to my practice, but from for a low cost, predictable, budgetable membership model, if you can see your doctor as much as you want, not have to pay copays and such when you see them, you may be able to be less remiss to see them when it's necessary. And when I use Netflix and things of that sort, it's to kind of show that actually the average gym membership is about what the average direct primary care practice costs. So imagine being able to see your doctor as much as you want, telemedicine, you know, being able to access them after hours and such, and it not costing much more than your average cell phone bill or gym membership.
So, Dr. Savage, that sounds good, but now a lot of doctors around, and including my GP, who's very good, and she replaced my previous GP who had retired after many successful years, you know, they do work for these major conglomerates, who buy out these practices and say, okay, you can still work for us, and you're going to see twice as many patients a day. So are the major forces in healthcare still kind of overlooking some of you folks in the medicine field and going, well, yeah, that sounds all good, but you really don't want to upset us and go do that, wink, wink. I mean, what's the dynamic here, if there is one?
Oh, absolutely. The unfortunate truth is all the layers of bureaucracy that are in the healthcare system are very lucrative. I would estimate that about half of what we spend in healthcare costs in the United States actually go to bureaucratic processes, many of which are not advantageous to the patient, but are very, very costly. We spend almost $4.5 trillion in the United States on healthcare every single year. And if my estimates are correct, that about half of that is bureaucratic waste. That means we're spending over $2 trillion on medical bureaucracy every single year. And it's not only insanely expensive, because people just, these numbers are so absurd and large that people can no longer conceptualize them, but they are paying for them. They're paying for them in taxes. They're paying them in premiums. They're paying for them in deferred wages when their employer takes that out to give them a health care benefit. They're paying them in co-payments and such. But they are paying for them in the end. And it's not only costly, but it's intrusive. They're telling your doctor, just like you mentioned, how many patients they can see, what they can prescribe, to whom they can refer. So it's a very controlled relationship. Well, our concept is, if possible, and there's ways of combining what we do in direct primary care with less costly coverage products, so you still cover that unexpected expense if, God forbid, you're in the hospital. But there are ways of extracting those, because primary care is cheap in reality. Once you strip away all once you strip away all the extra waste, primary care is actually inexpensive. And so we're trying to get back to that so that that doctor can take care of you in the way they know is best. And for example, we spend 30 minutes to an hour with our patient is actually how we schedule for each visit. So when we tell people at the end of the visit that, we say, hey, do you have anything else going on? We actually mean it. We're not desperate with our hand on the doorknob at the end of that five-minute visit to get out to the next room.
A couple more minutes here with one of our healthcare guys, a return visit from Dr. Chad Savage, talking about a concept called direct primary care. He's the founder of Your Choice Direct Care in Brighton, Michigan, so he's not seeing anybody locally here in Connecticut, but this is an expanding field where, doctors try and spend a little more time with their patients, hold down the costs here, and try to break out of this paradigm where it's lather, rinse, repeat. Go to the doctors, pay your copay, get a bill if anything happens, and we go round and round and round. And to that end, Dr. Savage, it does drive me crazy that, we talk to people like you that have good ideas, and other people I have on this show talking about healthcare, whether it's direct primary care or healthcare cooperatives or concierge care. But everything, every year, Dr. Savage, just gets more and more expensive. And we never get explanations for that. And I have to chuckle, keeping that in mind, every so often on Facebook, I see a social media post from, 40, 50, 60 years ago, childbirth, $100. You know what I mean? Gave you a receipt, back in the 20s or 30s, birth of one child, 10, $20. I mean, it's amazing where we are now.
Yeah, well, it's not ironic that in the cash pay models of practice of medical care, that the few that exist out there, like plastic surgery and such, the prices are not going up at anywhere near the same rate that the rest of the system. It's really interesting because when you refer to that, you're really talking to the insurance premium,
sure,
things of that sort, and that system is skyrocketing. We're talking 10% increases in premium costs per year, which year over year is just are unsustainable. And eventually we are going to run out of enough money and people are going to be deciding between food and healthcare. And that's the end point where you can't increase beyond that point. Well, we should never get close to that. So the good news is, people talk about so much a parallel economy within our current system for geopolitical reasons and otherwise. But we actually do have that in healthcare. It's emerged where we have a cash pay version of healthcare. We have it in the primary care field with direct primary care, what I do. And the key is we actually do have to make it affordable. We recognize that when we're accountable to our patients, they are the end consumer. Our interests are aligned with their interests. We're not just trying to get the payment from the insurance company. They're not the substrate through which the payment from the insurance company comes. They are our boss. They reserve the right to fire us. And so that's a great incentive for us to provide them great care. But we also have to make it very, very affordable. And that's the beauty of direct primary care compared to something like concierge. But there's also cash pay surgical options. Now, I'm not saying that this is the model everybody should use.
Yeah.
But Oklahoma Surgical Center can do a spine surgery, if God forbid you need that, for around $10,000, where it's about $100,000 through the hospital systems. And then there are affordable coverage products that are alternatives to traditional insurance, like the health sharing ministries. And a couple years back, I wrote an example of my own family's experience with this. I left the hospital system about 7 years ago to open this clinic, and I was aghast when I started pricing out insurance products for my family of four. We were talking like $26,000 7 years ago in premium costs you know, before I ever see a doctor, $26,000 out the door, going to that insurance company to never be seen again, just for the for having that piece of plastic in my pocket. Well, I looked around and I found something called Health Sharing Ministries, and there, and I'm personally part of one called Samaritan, but there's MediShare, Christian Healthcare Ministries, sure, and many others out there. Well, in 5 years, by combining cost-effective quality primary care with direct primary care with a more cost-effective coverage product for if I end up in the hospital like my Samaritan Health Ministries, my family of five saved $88,000, not by rationing care, not by avoiding care. In fact, I'd argue getting better care and never paying for it at the point of service, meaning I walk in and see my direct primary care doctor and they don't charge me for doing so. And if you think about that, $88,000 in 5 years in savings, which if you extrapolate that to a decade, that's a modest house in saving.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, you know, finally, Dr. Savage, I think you touched on this a few minutes ago. Are we ever going to get to a tipping point where we can fundamentally, I mean, really lower costs in this country? Or are the costs still going to rise because somebody says, hey, you know what, we can charge whatever we want because the insurance companies will pay it and they'll pass the costs on to people and people will pay it because somebody's going to tell them, hey, 10 or 12 grand for insurance a year, that's a lot better than getting saddled with a bill for 100 grand for a bypass operation.
Well, you nail it about how we can, well, if we send it to the insurance company, as long as they pay for it, it's all good. And I don't want to get too in the weeds. I know we're limited time, but there are actually stipulations within the ACA that I think, which is Obamacare, which inadvertently drove that, where insurance companies on one side say they're trying to save money, but they can only collect a certain percentage of the total health care costs. So if total health care costs go down, they're drawing that set percentage of a smaller number, so they're actually harmed by cost reductions. So under the current system, no, I don't think you're going to see that until literally, again, people are choosing between food and health insurance. But the good news is when people – what you need to solve that is agency combined with transparency. We got to stop giving the money, at least in large amounts, to – everybody should have insurance or coverage of some sort for calamity – but don't overspend on that. We're massively overspending on coverage. Keep most of that money in your pocket. We need to bring back economic training in our schools, so, you know, home ec and personal finance, so people don't squander the money. They have it in a rainy day fund, so if something, you know, untoward happens, they have some money to cover it. But the patients will actually solve this, because if they have agency, they have control of their own dollars, and they have transparency, and they know what the costs are, they will make the rational decision-making that will cause a consumer price war where people will start, trying to provide higher quality and better price services to capture that instead of just figuring out what they can get away with by billing the maximal to the insurance company.
Good thoughts, Dr. Chad Savage. Check out his op-ed and the other stuff he's done, realclearhealth.com. Hey, Dr. Savage, thank you. We appreciate the time. Good luck again, and we'll chat with you down the road. Thank you.
Pleasure, Paul. Have a good one.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. There you go. Yeah, look. You know, the stuff is expensive. It continues to be expensive. The treatment you get, the procedures you get. And what do? I know there's a lot of good insurance companies. I know I'm speaking in the state that employs a lot of great insurance people. It doesn't mean that they're the fault here, but the general way that healthcare is conducted right now, you know, I would think something maybe sort of kind of has to change. Maybe or maybe not. What do I know?